Hello, welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20 plus years together of collecting films on what are now obsolete formats. Our film for this episode is Westworld from 1973, and we have it on CED Selectivision video disc. Speaking of retro futuristic whatever, getting it from, I believe, Retroteque in Morgantown, West Virginia, where most, about 90% of our CED collection came from into big purchases from them. So yeah, Westworld, 1973. I guess I should explain the plot a little bit. I mean,
well, if you watch The Simpsons Treehouse of Terror, you would know the basic plot when they go to the mouse and the cat,
Itchy and Scratchy
Itchy's world.
And
the robots go a little crazy.
Yes, and there was also the Duff Gardens episode. There were elements of Westworld and Duff Gardens as well.
That's true.
So yeah, it's a near future. So we have to talk about, you know, the great Robert Hughes quote, "Nothing dates faster than our vision of the future."
Absolutely.
So it's a near future where AI robots exist. So it's the 1973 vision of, I think, AI robots, all of it. And you can go on vacation as an adult into these places where there kind of are no rules. There kind of are suspended morality because it's humans and a bunch of robots. And you could pretty much do whatever you want to the robots in either Westworld, which is 1880s. Hi, Libby. That's our dog scratching right now. 1880s West, the Roman Empire, or medieval times.
Yeah.
And yeah, for $1,000 a day, you can go and indulge your superego.
For the 70s, $1,000 a day would have been, like, that's even a lot of money now.
Well,
but, like, $1,000 a day back in the 70s, wow.
So I did an inflation calculator,
okay. And
the Josh Brolin, Richard Benjamin characters, they make a comment about this, $1,000 a day, it's a week vacation, so $7,000. Adjusted, at least the online inflation calculator, it's a $40,000 vacation.
Wow.
So, generally affluent. $40,000 in today's money.
Yeah.
For a week in this simulated mechanical world.
Yeah.
Where you get to do whatever you want. And you know, it kind of starts with the commercial.
The first
thing you see, and I thought, actually, so part of CED Selectivision is, it is a giant vinyl record in a hard shell case.
Yeah.
And I thought somehow I had put the movie in wrong. Because you don't know. Like, there's the outside tells you it's side A and side B. Or side one and side two. And there's also you can't... there is a mechanism to keep you from putting the disc in wrong. I thought I'd started on side two or something. I was like, is this thing in backwards? Like, how is this, you know... Yeah. Because you can't really, you don't get to see the record. If you don't know what I'm talking about, CED Selectivision, check out the Techmoan 30-minute video on YouTube. It's 20, 30 minutes long on YouTube where he explains this wondrously flawed, failed, terrible technology.
That's in a giant plastic disc. It looks like a giant plastic diskette, actually.
Yes, it's the format, because the format is so fragile, other than, to steal a joke from The Simpsons, other than being sexually attracted to fire, there's no way that this thing would be any less hardy than it is. It is quite... But anyway, I thought I'd put... Because it starts with the commercial. It's about people. You fly in this spaceship-looking thing to this world somewhere. And it's people's testimonials of, I went here and I had all the things I could do.
And actually, for me, it was interesting because there's a woman who talks about being in Roman world. And the Roman Empire world. And she says, and the men. And so right away, he just addresses that people are having sex with
their... Yeah, I mean, it's sex tourism. It's violence tourism. The one guy was like, I shot four people. I mean, I don't think they were people, but, you know. So it is this playground of the rich, tourist, corporate experience. that just allows you to indulge any, if you're wealthy enough, if you can afford it, you can indulge any desire in this world. And as it's a Michael Crichton wrote and directed this.
And this was his directorial debut.
And this was his directorial debut. And so you think the guy who did Coma in Jurassic Park.
Which is this, like, Jurassic Park Congo. Is, like, literally the same premise.
Yes.
Actually.
Our technology, we've done really smart things, we have cool experiences, and then we're screwed. Basically because of the things that we make.
In some ways, if you saw Jurassic Park, you've seen Westworld.
Yes. It's, yeah, exactly. It's, if you're like, man, I really wish Jurassic Park was a Western without the dinosaurs. Have we got a film for you? That's the plot of Westworld. Watching it on this format, and so the movie skipped. I think we missed one important line of dialogue in the last third of the film. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do?
So I think it's interesting, too, because it's like, so it would have been the, 1968, 1969 with HAL.
73.
No. I mean, HAL with 2001, A Space Odyssey, right? So HAL is kind of like the evil sentient computer that everyone thinks about. And so it's like the 70s, we kind of start getting these movies that have this theme of like computers running amok. In this case, it's cyborgs or androids, whichever one you want to say. Mm-hmm. There was the Demon Seed in, like, 77. And so, you know, it kind of is a part of this group of films that's worried about the future and worried about the impact of technology and our dependence on technology, which I think is really fascinating.
Which reminds me of now, because it is the date and the time and the two main characters are boomers. Mm-hmm. The great Saturday Night Live skit about robot insurance and that elderly people are terrified of robots. And maybe this is where it starts. Or maybe, you know, I remember even talking to one of your aunts before Y2K and her saying that I think some of my generation hopes the lights do go out in 2000 because then, you know, computers get resisted for a while, or that, you know, that world doesn't seem very real to us.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, this deep dive in anxiety over machines and computers, and speaking of, though, that idea of our vision of the future being dated very quickly, this is a world where bigger computers mean better computers. because there's a control room of big switches and lights and giant reel-to-reel tape machines spinning, which is very the world my dad lived in. You know, my dad was an engineer for IBM, and I remember him saying that, you know, once, like in 1983, they thought computers were not going to get any faster because you couldn't make them any bigger. You know?
Yeah.
And so that was it. And talk about, you know, and that's what IBM believed, the biggest computer company in the world at the time, bigger, better. So there is these elements of computers.
The one thing I thought that was interesting now, I know you have a different thought about it, but the kind of, they actually end up talking about a virus, right? So the one engineer is saying that there seems to be spreading from cyborg to cyborg, and it's infecting the different worlds. And so that's actually a thought of a virus. And so I looked it up, and actually John von Neumann in 1949 actually was the first person to come up with this theory that you could have a virus where something is self-replicating in terms of a computer and technology. And so, and actually in looking at this, it is mentioned that Westworld was the first movie that kind of touched on it.
Yeah.
There was some other novels in the 70s that touched on a little bit, but Westworld was the first film to kind of touch on that concept of a virus and a virus being able to spread from, you know, and for this cyborg to cyborg, but computer to computer. Which was kind of actually interesting, right? That was something that Michael Crichton could think of and come up with.
And could use. And I think there's also a great line early in the film
there was this head scientist or head computer engineer who has some alarm about this and mentions that, you know, we don't actually know how some of these things work. We're in control, in the control room over, but we don't know how these things work. Some of the, because the machines themselves. And so I even think about, you know, the way, you know, a lot of people have anxieties over technology. And here's someone who would be watching this film on CED that might not know that their TV has to be on channel 3. And my, you know what I mean? Because that, I mean, that's like we all, I think we all have a moment where we check out with the technology in our lives. And for some people, back then it would have been, what channel's the TV supposed to be on to watch this movie?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But
yeah,
they said about how, you know, even the scientists don't know what these machines can do.
Yeah.
And this movie, and Crichton made a career of tapping into this anxiety of things that are sort of greater than humankind.
Yeah.
Or have their own agendas beyond humankind, which... Hey, we're watching this in the summer of 2020, COVID-19. You know, some people can't accept that there's a virus that really doesn't care about our desires to go to the store. It just wants to replicate in people.
Yeah.
You know, and people can't deal with the fact that we haven't fixed this by now, or that I have to make sacrifices to fix this. So all of that in the human relationship with technology is...
You know, for me, like, of course, again, 2020 pandemic, and, you know, one of the head scientists says we should close the park for a month to fix it.
Yeah, to fix it.
And so they're like, no, we can't close the park. So they agree not to accept any new, to say they're overbooked. So new tourists don't come in, but they don't evacuate the current tourists.
So there's always this, cost-benefit analysis that happens in human safety.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, right now, you know, on social media, everyone keeps posting the scene from Jaws where the mayor doesn't want to shut down the beach. Why isn't there any memes about Westworld? The same principle.
Same principle, yeah. And it may be a very uniquely American story, culture problem.
Yeah.
You know, in that, we also, let's face it, as a culture, really struggle with, just because we can, should we? And if the technology is there, why not? And also the technology being in sort of the hands of bean counters who maybe don't make human decisions but make financial decisions.
Right. Which also is the premise of Jurassic Park as well.
Yes.
Right?
So, yes, exactly. Again, if you just, if you're like, Jurassic Park's cool, I just wish this was a Western without the dinosaurs in it, this is your movie.
Yeah. Now, so it's Michael Crichton's directorial debut.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because like Jurassic Park is in the 90s. And so I kind of forget that, like, actually Michael Crichton was probably in his 30s when he directed Westworld in the 70s. So he kind of, because Jurassic Park came out so late in his writing career and that film came out so late, you kind of forget he's been around for a while. Yeah. That for me, it's just in terms of the film, the pacing for me is a little weird.
Yeah.
And I also think that not everyone can handle really well of shifting tone of film.
Mm-hmm.
And so initially it comes off as kind of like this, in some ways, like a comedy, and like they're joking around, and I get it sets the tension that, but then there's the dramatic shift that happens. And so so for me, it's kind of like, it seems like two different films and he didn't make the transition from one to the other very well.
No, he doesn't. And for me, the pacing, I was like, is this first time director or is this just a 70s film?
Oh, that's true.
Because a lot of 70s films do have that. I know our theater director who we took undergraduate film art together, actually in the same class. That's insider baseball for folks in the podcast. We took film art together.
We did.
The same class so many years ago. the idea of impressionist cinema.
Yeah.
That you're supposed to sit, like an impressionist painting.
Yeah.
You're supposed to sit in the mood and sit in the world. And
yeah.
That things, I mean, the ridiculous example of this was The Hunger, which we watched for that class, which I hate that film. I know we need to crap for that, but.
We have to review it sometime and talk about it.
We
got
to
do
it. Watch it again.
I know, but we have to do it. We have to do it for the sake of the podcast. Yeah, I mean, I think
the sacrifice.
So there is some, you know, really strong directors who can do that, right? And they can, and you appreciate the journey that happens with it. I could see, you know, I definitely think Michael Crichton had ambitions beyond the medical and technology dramas and sci-fi that he was doing. I'm sure he had ambitions beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, probably doing a film about killer robots was his way to get to direct a film.
Mm-hmm.
So did he probably have aspirations to be kind of art house type of film? Probably. But does he have the chops for it?
No, but I think he's got, I mean, there is a cold distance to it. You're right. And it is a very third wall, almost proscenium arch kind of film, you know, that you have this, you are always on the outside looking in a weird way. That's the feeling, at least I got from watching the film. Yeah.
I also think, I mean, I think, you know, like, we knew the premise going in.
Yeah.
But I think also, like, I think he could have also done a better job of kind of dropping hints, right? Maybe, like, there's, like, an android who, like, drops a glass by accident. Like, these slight little hints that, like, things are starting to...
Well, I see. I found it was the opposite. I found it was very heavy-handed. You know, because there's these behind-the-scenes... There's elements of the film that are very heavy-handed. The behind-the-scenes stuff. A lot of those characters in the control room who are the robot mechanics.
Who explain the whole film.
Who
like they
explain the whole film.
Explain the whole film.
They do that bad that fiction writing 101 thing that you're supposed, that you learn not to do in fiction writing 101 is, you know, have the characters say exactly, most directly what the audience needs to know at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, they're all very flat characters. They are all just basic. There is a problem with this in Sector 3. You know, I mean, they're very... And so the heavy... There's a very heavy-handed element to that for me. And, and I think it's even... There's a final scene where... again, the problem with this podcast that we do spoilers... Where, you know, as things are going nuts, one of the characters finds his way into the bowels of the machinery. And he finds his way. And so, of course, the conflict between man and machine then goes into this cold, clinical, robot factory place. And I found myself going, oh, that's cool, and that's clever, and that's also really obvious. Like, of course he has to go down the man through the manhole cover into the bowels of the machinery to have this conflict.
Yeah.
And for part of it, it was like, me's like, okay, yeah, you got to make that move, but also, yeah, you made that move, you know. So there's elements that are very predictable, and there are a number of robotic characters that are actually human beings in this film.
Well, I think that the thing that for me, like, yeah, so it's these two separate worlds that are happening. So you're in the control room with the engineers and scientists, and then you're with the guests. And you're switching between those two different scenarios, right? And so in the control room, they tell you the whole plot. Like, they tell you the whole story. You know exactly where the story is going. Like, it just tells you. But the guests don't have a hint until they're stabbed. Right?
Yes.
And so, like, for me, it was really weird because it's like, I feel like it could have been handled better, right? So it could have been a technician being like, as I mentioned, like, oh, she just dropped a wine glass. That's weird. I wonder if it's okay.
Or that the tourists themselves notice the glitches.
Correct.
I mean, yes,
there
is a mechanical snake bite, and that's supposed to be the moment.
But that's
but
so
should
far
there be
into the film.
A place where... You know, somebody's language, you know, and they're talking and somebody skips a record, or somebody just kind of rando shuts down in the middle of a conversation or something like that. Because they're saying, you know, there's this interesting push me, pull you, where they're saying that the hands are the only things. There's this interesting tension early in the film because they can't get the hands perfectly human right.
Yeah.
And that's how you tell who's a fellow tourist and who's a cyborg, is through, or robot or whatever, is through the hands.
Yeah.
And so that's an interesting tension, which then kind of disappears after the first third of the movie.
Yeah, because there isn't any time beyond the scene. There's a scene where one of the guests meets a technician in the desert, and the technician says, "Let me show you your steam. I want to see your hand." And that's the only time, right? So there's not, like, really these moments where it's...
And the technician explains what's happening with the robots.
Exactly. And there's not a point in time where, like, a guest in a moment of survival has to look at the hand to figure out, like, oh, is this a robot or is this a person, right? And so, yeah, so it's, like, that kind of hint that happens down. And for me, the snake happens so late in the film for the guest. And then it becomes, in some ways, it goes from this, like, fantasy film, a sci-fi film, to then a chase film.
Mm-hmm.
And so that also for me is kind of a little weird, the transition to the chase film. Though Yul Brynner is a great killing machine, I think.
Yes, Yul Brynner does Terminator really well.
He does that fantastic. I was really impressed with Yul Brynner-ness of being a kill machine. He's the person for that role.
He's maybe the second best Terminator of all the Terminators. I will say that. The Liquid Cop in T2 is pretty good, too. It's like Yul Brynner, Liquid Cop guy from T2. In terms of Terminators, Yul Brynner is the second best Terminator. Yeah. Is.
And I think, you know, there is... Also, like, you think about it, so Blade Runner would have come out 83 maybe, or early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, you had Blade Runner, but that's based on a book, I want to say, from the 60s. And one of the androids in that is a sex droid, right? Like, she's a forced sex slave. And so part of her rebellion is she just doesn't want to be a sex slave anymore.
Yeah.
And so I guess there, you know, there was a part of that that I was looking for, because, I mean, really, they're very honest about the many of the guests just there to sleep with the robots or the androids. So you do have this, like, brief moment where an android refuses. Yes.
And it's that the android is broken. Which is, I think, interesting. You know, I will say one of the things that on my timeline this morning, you know, scrolling through, and we talk about technology and ethics, but that, you know, deep fake pornography, actually most internet deep fakes are actually porn, are actually people's faces imposed on other bodies, so that face, that person, you know, you can have a sex tape of that person, you know, and I guess there are places out there where you can buy this.
Kristen Bell from Frozen is a classic one that this keeps happening to.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it is this question of when we get a new technology or there's this technological advance, how does that reshape our world? How does that reshape maybe our moral contracts? And also, yeah, what does that allow us to indulge? And for me, the interesting thing is, yes, this film, 1973, we're watching it in 2020. You know, of course, we have the first-person shooter games. We have VR is still, I think, only showing us a small element of what it can do and the entertainment possibilities in our lives. We have the idea of augmented reality. We have, you know, we do very much live in a world where it's maybe not a place we go to, but it's a place in our home where technology allows us to indulge desire in interesting ways.
Well, I think it's so funny because we were in the college in the 90s, and we were just having this conversation that when we were renting our house, we didn't have internet access.
Yeah.
You had to go to campus.
The internet was a place you went to.
You had to go to campus.
There was a room for the internet.
To get to the computer lab. And this was very common in the 90s. And, you know, like, how many people I'm sure you know of, who went to the computer lab and downloaded a bunch of porn.
Yeah.
And it was early internet, but that
was... It was early internet, but it was one of the first things people... I mean, there is that theory that, well, not only did the internet make, or porn make the internet, because you had to build that infrastructure and you had to have something that people needed to buy.
Yeah.
But also, you know, there's that, you know, if we're talking about films from the VHS era, the back room in the family mom and pop video store
yeah.
is maybe what really made the VCR or the CED player for that matter something that people were going to put money out for.
Yeah.
You know, this ability we can, so it's like meta what yeah. we're doing. I even think about, you know, when they're on the plane spaceshipy thing going the West world or Roman world or medieval world, they get these like color coded name tags. And it's like now our friends that have kids who go to Disney World, you get the wristbands
yeah.
that come in a box and it's oh, we have this thing that we're going to have this experience.
Yeah.
So there's an element of even of Jean Baudrillard in this. I can't say this, you know, this idea of simulacra, mm-hmm. this idea of that we live in a world of copies and fake experiences.
Yeah.
And is that what modernity, that's how where modernity turned to post-modernity
mm-hmm.
in that, you know, we can now, everything is just a commodity and everything is just an experience and there is no truthful, because again, if you went to Roman times or medieval times or the Wild West, you'd probably be dead in about 2 weeks.
No, right.
A modern, comfortable person who's used to air conditioning and has had vaccines
yeah.
and has a degree of food security, though, again, we're, you know, entering as we are the new dark ages, you know, maybe that's not for every, food security isn't unfortunately yeah, for everyone anymore. Yeah. But, you know, the sense that there's a tuna melt somewhere in your future and that you can get the food that you really want, not the food that you need to survive.
Yeah.
And that we can be a tourist in those times.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, the idea that the past can be this fertile imagination for our modern id.
No, I agree with you completely. And for me, it was really funny when the two friends arrive in Westworld. And they go to their accommodations and they're told like, oh, we provide breakfast and dinner for you. Lunch is on your own. And so right away, it's this, they still want that comfort of that we're getting food and things like that. And that, you know, there is a girl gunfight early on that the android is killed. In theory, it's not really killed, but an android is taken out, and the, you know, of course, none of the bullets hit the humans. There is definitely this nostalgia for the past, but not thinking about what the reality of that past was. Like, there would have yeah. been dysentery, there would have been sexually transmitted diseases, there would have been people dying from, you know, just even a simple cut from a knife you could die from, right? Because
yeah,
there wasn't penicillin.
I remember hearing, you know, because you think even like white nationalists mm-hmm. have gone to the classical era and the medieval
yeah.
era to say, oh, look, there was this perfect white world once.
Yeah.
And a friend of ours who's an anthropologist talking about actually seeing the bones of medieval people and looking at, you know, the remnants of a medieval human and going, yeah, no, you don't want that.
Yeah.
You don't want that. Let's
Absolutely.
Look at, you know, why this leg bone is crooked or,
yeah.
you know, or you can look at that bone and say, like, this was the year that that person didn't have food.
Yeah.
You know, in their childhood based on. But yeah, so it is that simulacra simulation thing. So there's also a weird play on nostalgia in the premise of this film.
Right.
And nostalgia for experiences we didn't actually have.
Exactly. And, you know, for Richard Benjamin and for Josh Brolin's characters, and even the kind of nerdy guy who is, like, in the periphery
mm-hmm.
With them, he looks like some, you know, accountant or something.
They are professionals, right?
They are.
They are a businessman and a lawyer.
And so they, you know, it's this opportunity to be manly men. They're in bar fights. They sleep with prostitutes. They're drinking lots of whiskey.
They're in gunfights.
They didn't get a chance to do the bank robbery. One of them just becomes sheriff.
Yes.
And so it's also this like sense of we're getting an opportunity to be manly men because now we can't, you know, being a lawyer, I'm not a manly man, which is really weird.
Which is very weird, which is very, you know, I should say we watched, and I guess we could have done an episode on it because it was on VHS, but we not too long ago had a friend over for a socially distant backyard movie. We watched Duel from 1971,
yeah.
which again is this businessman
kind of getting his masculinity back, or there is this masculine anxiety, which we think about the latter 20th century. We could even go back to episode 2 and All the Right Moves, thinking about, you know, a man's value at one time was his own intelligence, his own cunning, the strength of his back. That performative masculinity was very much about, well, what skills do you have? Mm-hmm. What strengths do you have? And there were these arenas that were exclusively masculine.
Yeah.
Whereas we now, you know, part of maybe also the anxieties of 2020 is you have a generation of people who have that idea of masculinity, where we all live in a world, or most of us live in a world, where that just nobody cares.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how strong your back is, how smart are you, how good of a communicator are you, how creative are you? And in some ways, you know, those are definitely not masculine only traits. And in some ways, traditional masculinity sees those traits as feminized.
That's true.
Right? And so yeah. There's a lot of people who would love to just, you know, can't we just be unskilled coal miners again and make a living, right? I mean, that's right. Part of the premise, right? Wouldn't it be great if we just be unskilled, strong back, and make all the money?
Yeah.
Which is not how our world works. And there's a lot of, I think, misplaced masculine anxiety over it. And so in an interesting way, this film explores gender from that, you know.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, it's the woman wanting to be the ghost of Roman world wanting to be ravished. Whereas the guy in medieval world who the robot rejects, I mean, he grabs her and just figures, he kisses her and that should be enough for seduction.
Yeah.
You know, she should just melt in his arms and take off her clothes, you know. Which is... I don't know. You know, it explores it, I think, in a critical enough way you don't say it's problematic. Because it does... you do get the sense of like, oh, yeah, he's showing us something.
Yeah.
Maybe about ourselves in this film.
Yeah, I think it... You know, it's so funny, too, because I think he is... Like, I do think Michael Crichton is trying to talk about... you know, in some ways, like corporate culture, right?
Yes.
Of not wanting to shut it down, knowing that people could be harmed. Mm-hmm. I think he is talking a little bit about perceptions of masculinity. I think he is trying to have a social commentary that probably gets lost with the killbot aspect of it.
Yeah.
But I do think he is making an attempt at social commentary that is lost a little bit with how the film ends.
Yeah, which is interesting to me because you think then about the audience for this film.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're a professional, upper middle class professional, you know, are you seeing an element of yourself? And if you're working class, are you looking at, aha, you know, look at those rich people trying to be...
Yeah.
Trying to get in bar fights as tourists. I mean, there's also, I can't not bust out other great grad school quote, the Jamaica Kincaid line, a tourist is an ugly human being,
mm-hmm.
from her book, A Small Place, about being growing up Jamaican, and that, you know, if you are affluent enough, you can get lost in someone else's boredom.
Mm.
And someone else's boredom is this exciting new thing for you.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, there's that great film Life in Debt that uses narration from A Small Place. And they're looking at, you know, Sandals Resorts in Jamaica. And these people are having this sort of pre-packaged, very reductive experience for their enjoyment.
Yeah.
Whereas life in Jamaica, especially at that time, was very, very much something else.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of the anxiety of this. It's, again, a lot of the critiques of Disney World, I can't also not mention Henry Giroux's The Mouse That Roared,
right.
About the values kind of buried in the pleasure that people get from Disney and that sense of wholesomeness and that reductiveness, is that maybe there's some nefarious things happening in there. And I think they certainly happen in Westworld as well.
I agree. I also think about the, in some ways, the legacy of Westworld. because actually, you think about it, Hostel is a very similar premise.
Yeah, because
it is kind of the playground of the wealthy. So these the one character is very wealthy. His friend is not wealthy, but wealthy men and women being able to pay for this experience of killing others.
Yeah,
which this is actually Westworld. It's either you're sleeping with someone or you're killing someone.
Yeah,
that's the two things.
You're fighting or you're fucking. Yeah,
yeah, and so that's kind of how it's reduced. And so Hostel just takes it to the killing side, right?
Yeah.
Well,
there's a sexualized element to Hostel.
No, that's true. No, you're absolutely right. You're right. And then Cabin in the Woods. I think Cabin in the Woods was highly inspired by this. Just looking at it, that kind of premise of this whole other world. You have operators who are running this world and the simulation,
mm-hmm.
and you get to see the behind the scenes of what's happening and it falling apart and shutting down. Which I think is fascinating. So, and in watching it, you could see people who were inspired by this film. So mm-hmm. it definitely has, even, you know, in a sense, Terminator would be in some ways kind of, I look at Yul Brynner as the killbot and I'm like, yeah, that's the Terminator, you know, that kind of thing. So there's definitely an interesting, you can see how it's still relevant for people. We have not watched the HBO series Westworld, but my understanding is it's actually really well done and it's handled really well. So it's kind of interesting to also see the impact it's had on directors and filmmakers.
And I think it is also, you think going back to how, you know, even there was the great uncut feature that used to be called Sacred Cows, and talking about, you know, very much poised 2000, they wrote a one on 2001 Space Odyssey in 2001 and say, no, that film's really about 1968 and boomers who weren't ready for technology or were afraid of computers.
Yeah.
And we still though have that degree of anxiety that's always in our periphery. Of course, our boomer president, you know, wants to ban
TikTok
because it's a foreign computer thing that he doesn't understand.
Yeah.
I've looked back to, you know, you think there was, what year was that? In the early 90s, the vote in Congress to outlaw the internet.
Yeah.
And talking about how the vote went, I remember watching something on the news saying the vote went not on partisan lines, but which Congress members had email or not. And there were members of Congress that had, I mean, well, John McCain, actually boomer, when he ran for president in 2008, said he had never sent an email.
Wow.
He lived in a world without email.
That's insane.
I have family members who don't have email. So it's hard for us to imagine.
Yeah.
But I think we do have this anxiety about, you know, cybercrime and getting hacked and hacking the election. And, you know, that's in some ways our... That anxiety over our sort of empirical, I can see it, I can smell it, I can touch it, I can move it, understanding of the world versus the digital and the virtual and the technological, which, and even the scientific, which is so far removed, such a big part of our lives, but so far removed from our reality.
Yeah.
You know, I even think, like, my dad, speaking of the big computers, you know, before he died, I think I tried on three different occasions to explain to a former engineer at IBM how the internet worked.
I remember one time when we were visiting, he was asking you how a fax works, which was amazing. And he didn't get that either.
Yeah.
I was like, the internet and the fax just could not register.
And again, he was one of the best engineers in his department.
Yeah.
When it came to solving problems with computers that were a thing you walked into the CPU. He wasn't, you know, just a little chip, but a room that you went into. Yeah, he thought the internet was just one computer. There was one computer called the internet. And he got modems. He understood what a modem was, but not that it was this totally decentered server here, server there, server, you know, that you bounced between. Which, again, most people don't understand. But it's a big part of our lives. And so that, to me, is fascinating in 2020. Technology has moved so far on. We still have the AI thing.
Yeah.
We still, you know, self-driving cars or, you know, job anxiety because of AI.
Yeah. But we went all, like, having Alexa in our house, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to move on to the questions?
I guess so. I think we have to... Oh, we have talked long enough. So, yes, let's move on to the big five.
First question is, of course, is it camp, retro, a classic, or just an old movie?
In some ways, I feel like it's retro. What are your thoughts on it?
I think there is a classic element to it. I think if you, and that's, you know, question three, if you look past, and by the way, I looked up also, this was the first movie to ever have 2D computer animation in it.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, and I know the
movie that has anxieties about advances in computers is the first major feature film with computer animation in it, which, yeah. The irony!
And it was the point of view of the androids, right, or the robots.
Yes, yeah the pixelated Yul Brynner world in the final chase.
Yeah.
I think the fact that there are so many things that are still relevant to us, if you get past the effects, the things we've been talking about, this American maybe problem of corporate reasoning, corporate cost containment. I mean, you think it's even, you know, the Edward Norton character in Fight Club.
Yeah.
That's a real job. His job of calculating recall versus lawsuit settlement.
Yeah.
We live in the world, we live in the country where that is more important than anything.
Yeah.
And you know, the fact that we have the not only anxiety about technology, but I think also the way that we use technology to fulfill desire. And as this maybe weird moral parable, just because we can, should we?
Right.
You know, and I know in our culture, especially when it comes to entertainment, we have a hard time thinking like, yes, I like those kinds of movies. I like those kinds of games.
Yeah.
Is that good for us? Or is that doing, I mean, not that I want to be a Mennonite or anything, but there is a logic to, we live in the country that perfected the mass shooting and the first person shooter video game.
No, and I, you know, even thinking about that episode of Black Mirror where the game is implanted into your head.
Yeah.
And kind of then that character can't distinguish between reality and the game. And doesn't, I think, only lasts like 5 minutes or something like that, which I teach young children. And honestly, like, if you told my students you could implant a game, they'd be like, sure, like, let's do it tomorrow. Yes. And so I think... that is a really good point, because I do think that's exactly how this is going to go down. When robots are perfected, this is what's going
to
happen.
We're going to have sex bots.
And we are going to have these worlds that we can go into and exist. So I think in the sense, I think that makes it, I agree with you, thinking about it in that terms, it does have that classic film kind of elements. And it also spawned other films or influenced other films.
Yeah.
In some ways, I feel like, for me, Jurassic Park is a little bit more of the slicker film.
Yeah, I mean,
and visually
the
more
effects
interesting.
Are better,
And, you know, for me, they're both the same presence. It's premise. One is, you know, emotionless killer robots. The other is emotionless killer dinosaurs. But it's the same premise around the going to... you know, this experience that you can live and it goes horribly bad. So Jurassic Park for me has some elements that are a little bit better. But I'll agree with you in terms of the classic film.
All right. So then we talk about the social political distance of the film.
So
73 versus 2020, and how we're normal or moral or accepting of other people.
Well, it's actually kind of interesting because there are people of color in the film.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily... So what I was nervous about, it was that it was set in the Old West. Were there going to be slaves? And was there going to be other things like that?
Were there going to be slaves? Were there going to be magic Indians?
Were there going to be magic Indians?
Yes. Were there going to be Mexican banditos?
And that didn't happen, actually.
Yeah.
And so you did have tourists who were people of color. You did have technicians and engineers who were people of color. So it was kind of interesting. In a way, it was just like... As people of color should be, it was just that they were part of the environment.
Fabric
of the environment. Do I feel like there should have been more? Absolutely. But
yeah.
I think...
Did anyone have speaking roles?
The one scientist did. No, they did, actually. Yeah, I mean, not significant speaking roles.
But actually, the flat scientist characters who explain the technology and have no other lives.
And actually, Richard Benjamin is Jewish, right? And so he ends up becoming the lead of the film, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And then, oh, sorry, spoiler. That was a spoiler. Matt gave me a look. And then, of course, Yul Brynner. I mean, well, you know, the foreigner being the killbot, but Yul Brynner is Russian. He was born in Russia. And so I think, but I do think they were just kind of a fabric of the story. Could they have been bigger roles? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, my students years ago, when I was a teacher, my students were predominantly Black and African American.
Exclusively.
Exclusively.
Almost. Black. 99%.
So we actually looked at the Flintstones and the Jetsons, and we talked about how just like people of color didn't exist in the past or the future, and which is disturbing when you think about
it. Which is disturbing, which is also part of the why white nationalists are so obsessed with the classical era and the medieval era, because they believe that somehow Africans were not a thing.
Right.
Or,
that people of color did not exist, and that there wasn't trade routes, right? That you didn't get out of
there wasn't those trade routes. That Morocco was really that far away from Spain.
So I do, and some of the tourists were people of color, which then allows for that they were wealthy people of color, right?
Yes.
They were part of the fabric. Could they have had a bigger role? But for me, for the 1970s, that was actually kind of cool.
I think for me, going back though, is this weird thing. And again, part of how it's maybe still timeless or still relevant to us is the issue of masculinity.
Yeah.
And that these professionals are going to this place where they have to indulge being a man's man.
Yeah.
That you have to somehow get out of civil society to be a man anymore.
Yeah.
Is really interesting. And it not necessarily endorse. I mean, it doesn't end well. I mean, in the spoiler alert or not, it doesn't end well. There's a robot rampage.
Yeah.
But that, I find that fascinating.
Again,
like how many people play Call of Duty maybe to fulfill that?
Well, I actually also was kind of hoping for, so you had the commercial where the woman is just like, I was in Roman world, the men were amazing. And then you're on the plane and there's an older couple, and when they get to medieval world, he looks at his wife and he's like, and they get to Roman world and she kind of gives this little like hint at, you know, this kind of look of like, ooh, I can't wait to get to Roman world. Look at those men. So I actually was hoping that they would have had like a female protagonist where you could kind of talk about why she was in the world that she was, but it does focus on the two main male characters,
the two main professional
which is Richard Benjamin and Josh Brolin, who are two lead characters, and then and it's just really about their search for masculinity.
Even the milk toasty guy who becomes the sheriff, he has the morning after he wakes up and there's a beautiful woman in bed with him, and he has this like sort of incredulous look like, oh, what, I was able to do that, you know, I've reclaimed myself.
So unfortunately, the women in this are the majority
flat.
Of women are
flat characters, or they're robots. Robots,
or their purpose is robots to have sex with men.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So question three, another one is film from 1973, The Technical Distance. Talked about that a little bit. Yes, the effects are dated.
Yeah, they're very dated.
They are very dated.
Even the robot perspective, which at that time was the first time you had that pixelated look. It looks so bad.
It's less than 8-bit.
It is so bad. Yeah, it is so, so bad. And as you mentioned, the computers are massive and basically it was just like lots of flashing lights and spinning things and noises. That was their view.
Christmas lights. I mean, it was Christmas lights.
Yeah. And it was dials, so no sense that there would be touch screen or anything like that.
Touch
they were all dials.
Or keyboards even were kind of... No mouse?
No mouse. Yeah, it was very, very interesting. They were using telephones. So I think that's... So it's so funny. And even actually when they open up the robots, it actually looks like you're opening up your stereo speaker.
Yes.
And so even that...
The one, it's just a series of fuses. The one face is just... Oh, those are... glass bar fuses.
Yeah. So even that was kind of interesting because you expected when they opened it up to be...
Yeah, which I think for some people might be a Red Ryder BB gun block.
Yeah.
Heisman Trophy stiff arm, just pushing them out of the film.
Yeah.
Because of that. I will say that.
Yeah.
There is that element if you're watching, and especially if you're younger and maybe that idea of the digital native or whatever, that might push some people out. I think if I showed that film to my freshman students who were this year born in, 2002?
Yeah.
2003.
they might have a hard time getting into the film because of that reason.
I mean, absolutely. And it's not even a modern speaker, right? So it'd be the speaker, if you're a 20-something, it'd be the giant speakers that your parents used to have come alive and kill you. Like, that's literally what this is. So I do agree with you, the technology.
The anxiety is right. It's still on point. It's still right there. Absolutely. So, which then maybe leads us to, you know, we're already talking about then question four, the room test.
So I think that did take me out of the film a little bit, and also the worlds are decorated like you would expect them to be in the 1970s.
Yes.
And so that took me out of it a little bit, because you're like, oh, that's how someone from the 1970s would interpret the West or
Rome.
So that did take me out a little bit.
Yes, it was very contemporary but now dated medieval fashion, which again is... This is part of how we think about the past. We plunder the past.
Right.
For the aesthetic elements that we want. So is it a keeper? Question five?
It's a keeper. I don't know if I would necessarily watch it again a lot of times.
Well, it's on CED, so we might not be able to.
This is true.
It did skip a few times.
I honestly am curious about seeing the series and see how they take and evolve the story. But I would keep it because I do think it's an important film.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. See you next time, folks.